cat trees. I ordered one. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't have to give any accountability of donations that come in. That's been established. And if you send me money, I'm going to do what I want with it, which is probably partially why I've gotten less and less donations, but also just money's tighter. And, you know, people used to give me crypto back when crypto was free and easy. And then it went up to like actually worth something and a lot. And people were like, someone actually asked me to give back a Bitcoin donation. Did I tell you about that at one point?
I do remember that. Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, I gave you money and now that money that I gave you $100 and now that money is worth $1,000. Give it back. I was like, nope, nope. It's not how donations work. But I also have an Amazon affiliate link. If you shop on Amazon, you can go to Freedom Fiends, click on the affiliate link, and it doesn't cost you anything. And the Freedom Fiends get a little Amazon gift card cash. And I just got mine for the month. It was, I don't know, $55, $53, something like that. And I bought a cat condo because, you know, it's all about allocation of resources. We have three cats, and one of them is big and burly, Beast. Is his name. He looks like a panther. He's black. And he kind of takes up a whole cat, the top of a, you know, these are like not the tall cat trees. We have one of those in the corner too. They could fit on that and then some more cats. But we have the short stack one that's, you know, about a little higher. It's like it comes up to the bottom of the window. Exactly. Which is great because then we can sit them in the window. They can sun themselves, live the life of leisure. And, but they can't all really fit on one. So, you know, that's as rich as I need to be. I'm rich enough that I can afford a second cat tree. And that's nothing compared to a lot of people. But it's also, you know, a lot of people can't even feed their cat. And I have friends that live in vans. So, you know, they don't have a cat. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm going to help them get out of it. I'm going to teach them all the Michael Dean technologies for monetizing your art. Yeah, that's an announcement I have. So there's this band. I just called my friends poor, and now I'm going to talk about them. But they're young and they're poor. It's cute when you're young and poor. I lived in a van in the Bay Area, San Francisco, for a while when I was young and poor. But so, did you see what I posted yesterday about Vantana Row, the band from San Francisco?
No.
It's a two-person band, and I posted yesterday. Like I knew this kid, this guy Jamie. When he was like 7 to 9, I dated his mother. I was friends with his mother. And, you know, we dated for a while, then I was friends after still, and still probably friends with his mother. She's married. I'm married now. But I was friends with him, and we used to like go, you know, we went on picnics a few times and went, you know, out to lunch and hung out. And she brought him over to my house, and he played on my computer when he was 7, and I showed him things. And I liked him. He's a good kid. And it turns he's like 27 now or 28. I don't know. And he has a band called Vantana Row. And it's him and a woman, his sister. I talked about this last week, you know, and it's like I used to hang out with him and his sister. I'm like, oh, man, they have a band. It's great. And like I was like, wow, they really look like their mother. They're growing up. They're having a great time that you can totally tell they're her kids. And they live in a van. It's like brother and sister. It's like the White Stripes meet Death Grips. You know the band Death Grips?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, they're assaultive and wonderful. It's kind of Vantana Row are kind of trap rap punk screamo and then like some beautiful kind of ballady stuff. It's very eclectic. The guy does it all on computers, but he plays drums. And then they perform live they find out where like a big band is playing that night, like in a, you know, place with holds 1,000 people. They go pull up in the van, double park where the people are waiting in line to get in and do a drive-by show for 1 minute and then leave. They open the van windows. They have powerful speakers. They play a recording backtrack that has like bass and drums and synth, like really assaultive noises in it. He plays drums to it in the van, like a bass drum, a hi-hat and a snare. And then she screams through a microphone at them, and it's really musical. And then they throw CDs and flyers out the door and drive off. And
that sounds pretty cool.
It's cool. And there's videos of them doing this on YouTube if you search Vantana Row. And I'm going to collab with them. They're going to work on a Biptunia song with me. I'm going to work on a Vantana Row song with them. And it's really cool to like reconnect with them. And I'm sending them some gear that I'm not using because, you know, that's me. I give people gear. I might even give them Ben Stone's microphone. I was going to give it to a Liberty talker, but you know, there's no rule that says it has to go to like the next Ben Stone. It could go to the next Death Grips. We'll see. Yeah. But yeah. So
what kind of microphone did he use?
Ben? Probably the same one you're using. Audio Technica 2005 USB. Audio Technica?
Yeah, Audio Technica.
Yeah, that's basically a clone of the same mic that's, you know, 95% as good. It's a little USB mic. So Ben retired and he gave me his equipment. Well, he gave his equipment away. He gave other Shane Radliff, and Jeremy, who went to visit him, they did a last show together, and he's has health issues, so he's retiring, and he gave all his equipment to them, and some of it, he said, was for me, two microphones and this tube preamp that actually was mine. I bought it off Craigslist 12 years ago in Santa Barbara. Like, my wife and I drove from LA to Santa Barbara to pick it up. I bought it, and it's amazing. It's not really vintage, but it's old. It's probably, you know, 20 years old, and it's really good. And it's really good for music. It's better for music than podcasting. And I use that now with my, I gave it to Nima Vedati, and then Nima used it for a while. I used it for like 8 years. Nima, or 7 years. Nima used it for about three years, gave it to Ben. Ben used it a few years, and then Ben gave it back to me. It's a homing preamp. It's a tube preamp. Back when I was on, remember back when I was into tubes, people? Remember that? I talked nonstop about tubes on the show, and I still get a sale. Like, I look at my Amazon. I can't see who buys what, but I could see like what people bought through my affiliate link. And about once a month, somebody, probably not the same person, buys this certain tube that I always recommended. So I'm back to tubely goodness for music. But I don't need these other two mics. Ben sent me his like retrofitted Audio Technica 2005 USB. It's like he took a drill punch and punched the switch out and then just taped it over. So it's always on. So it's modded by Ben Stone. And he used it for the last couple of years making podcasts. And then he also sent me a Shure Beta 57A XLR mic, which is, I have better mics for recording to go to an XLR mic. This is a performance mic. This is a mic for the stage, and it's better than the standard SM57, SM58 everyone uses. Like, you know, the mic that's on stage at every club, it's like, you know, costs 1.5 times as much as that, and it's louder and has more high end and more clarity, and it's harder to break, and it's far more directional, so it won't feed back. So it's perfect for people that play loud, screamo, assaultive music in less than optional / combat situations. So yeah, it's going to them.
Right on.
Yeah, man. Oh, by the way, I made a huge mistake. It's funny though. Last week's show, I talked and I tweeted everywhere, and I Facebooked, and I told everyone that Vantana Roe were brother and sister. They're actually husband and wife, and the guy is the guy I used to hang out with, and the girl is his wife, not his sister. His sister is like off in the army or something, and this is not the same girl. But it looks we marry our mothers, basically. You know, his girlfriend, I think she looks like the mother. So I'm like, that has to be the girl, you know. But my wife says I see similarities in faces that aren't there. You know, like all the time we're watching TV and there's some character actor. And I'm like, that guy looks so much like my friend Mike Kelly. And she's like, I've met Mike Kelly. I don't really see it, you know. So maybe I thought it was her, so I wanted to think it looked like her. But but I think she's wearing hand-me-down clothes from the mother too. Like, her dress is similarly, makeup similarly, you know, just like attitude, similar attitude, man. It's weird. It's like, I don't know. We marry our mothers. I kind of married my mother. My wife has a lot in common with my mother. Boy, this just went down a weird, twisted road. But Jamie wasn't offended that I said that. He retweeted where I tweeted, check out this cool brother and sister band friend of mine's that live in a van. I knew them when. Yeah. So, yep.
Well, as far as resemblances go, I do think you have a resemblance to the Spicoli character.
Oh, man. Wait, when I... Spicoli. I sound and look like Spicoli. I don't now. I look very different than I did a long time ago. I've gained a bunch of weight, probably from prednisone more than anything. But I mean, actually, like, someone I hadn't seen in 20 years saw me the other day and like didn't recognize the picture as me. But until about you know, till I got sick and ended up in prednisone and gained 40 pounds, I looked enough like I did when I was a teenager that, like, somebody saw me in 2004 at NAMM, not NAMBLA. I'm not a member of NAMBLA, never would be. NAMM is North American Musicians Merchandisers or something. It's like a, it's like the gearhead show for musicians. It's at the Anaheim Civic Center. DJ and I went 1 year because, no, Lydia, it was before I was with my wife. My girlfriend before my wife went because I had a, I was at the booth there for when my book, $30 Music Film School, came out. My publisher had a booth there in the basement, you know, where nobody goes. And so I was there to, like, work the booth for a while and then walk around and see all the gear and see all the has-been rock stars signing, indoor, you know, endorsing stuff in person. And there was so, yeah, I'm at the Anaheim Civic Center, you know, getting lunch or something, and or the Anaheim Convention Center. And I hear this guy, I hear this voice go, Michael Dean, from across the room. And this guy walks up to me, and I'm like, I do not recognize him. And he introduced himself. He said, yeah, I'm a friend of Michael, Michael Sulkind's. I saw your band with Michael play at a record store, and I met you, and we hung out and talked afterwards. And that was in the year 1987, probably. And this guy hadn't seen me since then and recognized me in 2006, you know?
Yeah.
Which is, or it was 1987. No, it was before that. It was when I lived in D.C. It was 1984 or 84. Yeah, because then I moved to Charlottesville in 85. Yep. So he hadn't seen me in, you know, 12 years and recognized me. But yeah, Spicoli, when Fast Times at Ridgemont High came out, my mother saw the movie before I did. I think on a plane or something. And she's like, Michael, you've got to see this movie. I was like 13 or 14, maybe 15. And she said, you got to see this movie. There's a character in it. He's you. And I was kind of insulted when I finally saw the movie because, yeah, he looked like me. I had long hair. We had similar features. And he kind of sounded like me, but he was like a stoned dude. You know, he was, I joke though that I sound like a stone surfer and I'm neither. And that's based on Spicoli. His character was a surfer, right? I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the character in there, Ratzinger, is based on a guy I've interviewed, Andy. I think his name's Andy Ratliff. He's one of the writers for the Dummies series. He writes tech books. Like, he wrote Windows for Dummies. And he went to that school, and he went to, or he went to the school that's based on, and was, you know, one of the people that, one of the characters, Ratzinger, or Rat, what is he? Rat something. Yeah. Let's see. Fast Times, Windows for Dummies. I don't know. So, what do you want to talk about?
I also have one of those tall cat trees like you have in the corner, you said.
Yeah.
But I only have one cat, so
yeah, that's my enough.
Cat, as cat trees are concerned.
Andy Rathbone, just looked him up. Yep. Born in San Diego, attended San Diego. He's the character of Mark the Rat Ratner in the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Yes. Oh, yeah. Cameron Crowe wrote that, and he was friends with him then. Yeah. So what do you think of people who protest by blocking highways?
They're inhibiting your freedom of movement.
Yes.
Which is a violation of NAP.
Your non-aggression principle. Your non-
right.
A something I can't say on radio describing people principle. Yeah. The non butthole principle.
But basically, you know, freedom of movement is a negative right that we all are pretty much born with. It's kind of a natural law, in my opinion.
Yeah.
By blocking, you know, traffic, you're inhibiting people's freedom of movement.
You're basically arresting, you're detaining them. It's sort of like an arrest or a kidnapping. There's I got into arguments with people. What's that? You're creating a border. Yeah.
You're being a border.
You're being a border. It's funny, too, because people who do that are often very anti, you know, anti-border, anti-just anything the government does that doesn't involve giving everyone money, they're against. Yeah. I was arguing with this lady. Well, I'm not going to say her name because I don't know. But I was arguing. I posted this thing on Facebook. Did you see the meme that's... It says, this is how you protest government, and it shows Tank Man, and then it says, this is how you pee people off, and it shows people blocking a traffic line. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tank Man, do you know how to describe Tank Man?
I guess Tank Man would be the guy at Tiananmen Square who was blocking the tanks, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But somebody put a anarchy ball yellow and black and yellow anarcho-capitalist on his head, and then put the black and red, the anarcho-communist, on the, this is how you pee people off and people blocking the road. And it's, I kind of agree. I think that people who block highways or block roads, block freedom of movement, are first of all acting like the government they're protesting, if it's government they're protesting. And this picture, I'm pretty sure, is it was Minnesota or South Dakota. It's like Black Lives Matter protesting the police killing some black man. So they just went out and blocked a bunch of people who had nothing to do with it from going about their way. And actually, South Dakota had a bill, I don't know if it became a law, that basically would allow you to run over people that do this and, you know, beep and slowly advance towards them. And if they don't get out the way, run over them. And people thought that was extreme. What do you think of that?
Well, I guess when it comes to violations of the NAP or your freedom of movement, I still would try to use equal force and not too much great equal force that's necessary. So I guess I would escalate that as incrementally as possible until it maybe would come to that point, but hopefully it wouldn't.
Would an adequate, slow, incremental escalation of that be beeping your horn incessantly and driving 1 mile an hour toward the people and hope they move and not stopping if they don't?
Right.
Yeah. Here's the thing, too. I think it's a palatable threat. I think it's an actualable threat, because I just think of Reginald Denny, you know, in the LA riots. Yeah. You know, sometimes people block traffic and they drag people out of cars and beat them to death.
And sometimes those people who do try to break the lines that they're forming across the road, the traffic, sometimes they get their cars attacked too.
Yeah.
At that point, it does cross the line into actual initiation of force against you and your property.
And the thing is, with mobs, with big groups of people, it's a lot harder to judge the second-to-second progression of their aggression. You know, I mean, a lot of people are probably like, well, you know, we just wait and see and we don't beep. And but a mob can mob a car, you know, 20 people without even weapons can destroy people in a car and kill them in seconds. You know, they can pick up rocks, smash the windows. And if the person in the car is afraid to advance the car, because, oh, that wouldn't be the nice thing to do. You know, I think this is a really serious situation is what I'm saying. And I think there's a lot of people who argued against me, including some libertarians who were like, oh, you're so square. You're so reactionary. You know, why do you want, what does it matter if you're a little late to work? And then I think, too, about people having emergency situations. Like, a lot of times when someone's going somewhere, they have to get somewhere. Like, not to mention, you know, it could be a job interview of a poor person who is about to get the job that's going to advance their life and help pull themselves out of poverty, and they miss it, and the boss isn't going to be sympathetic, you know, or their first day of work. But it could also be a kid having a chronic asthma attack or a diabetic shock or anything where, you know, they have to get to the hospital. I actually saw the beginning of this in America, the popularizing of this in America. It happened before that. I think people did this about segregation in the 60s. But the recent, you know, past 20, 25 years, this has kind of been a thing. And lately, it's been more of a thing. I remember, do you know what the critical mass bike ride is?
I think I've heard of it.
It started in San Francisco when I was living there and was a bike messenger. And I joined it by accident one day. I was just riding home after a tough day of, you know, delivering packages up and down hills and in the financial district. And I rode onto Market Street down by Montgomery, and there were all these bikes. Like, everywhere there were bikes. There were hundreds of bikes in Market Street, which is a, you know, giant four-lane, you know, main artery in San Francisco. It's like Main Street, goes all the way through the city, pretty much. And it was just full of bikes. There were no cars. There were cars on side streets beeping, trying to get through, and bikes weren't letting them through. And I was like, what is this? This is cool. I didn't even notice the people beeping yet, because I got on another block where it was one way the other way, because I was a bike messenger and we don't obey traffic laws, because, hey, you know, anarchy, man. Back then, anarchy, you know, old anarchy, not traffic laws, but bike messengers risk their lives and risk other people's lives to do their job. Basically, they're we were crazy. I think they've largely been replaced by, you know, bonded couriers who obey all the rules and also don't cause unsafety. But, you know, And they fire the Mavericks now. They used to not fire the Mavericks because they had to get stuff there that had to be there in minutes, and now it's done with email, so it doesn't matter. But this is in the 80s, and they were blocking. It was great. It was like I got in it. I started riding in the direction I was riding in with all these other bikes, and it was silent. It was like it was weird being on a road with movement of vehicles, and it was almost completely silent. But then, like, we crossed some streets, and there were people beeping to get through, and then I saw someone, like, get off their bike and yell at the guy, and like, hey, and some guy was standing out of his car, like, hey, I'm with you guys, I understand, I used to protest too, but I have to get somewhere, and they were like, yeah, forget you, man, and then I was like, what is this, what am I in, what am I riding in, and I kind of, like, got grossed out by it, even before I was politically aware. I was grossed out that people were blocking the traffic of free passage, because I was a bike messenger, like my job was creating free passage, you know. It was like a mindset of things have to get there, things have to keep flowing, you know, people must flow. And it freaked me out. I didn't even know like what they were protesting, and it turns out they were protesting traffic. And originally this started as just a positive, I don't know if it'd be called a positive protest or a negative rights, but I don't know. It was basically a, hey, wouldn't it be neat if more people rode bikes and less people rode cars in the city to, you know, help with pollution and just gridlock. And that was the idea for the first few. I researched it later. And then somebody said it has to be political. It has to be angry, and turned it into a, you know, anti-cars, anti, and then it turned into an anti capitalism thing. And it was that, I guess, by this point. And I'd missed the first few of them because I was work, because I had a job. And it was weird. And now it's like that's a thing all over the country. And I've seen videos of like people in that, you know, when a car kind of like beeps at them, like I've seen people get out and like break the car window with their bike lock. So these darn kids.
And sometimes the protesters get run over. And that reminds me of an article, because you were talking about other people trying to get places. I think one time a protester got ran over, and then they called an ambulance, and the ambulance got stuck at another roadblock and couldn't get to him.
Who would not let an ambulance through? Did they not let an ambulance through, really?
Yeah, I guess so.
That's evil, man. Ugh.
That the ambulance was for one of the
protesters. Off with their heads. Wow. That's horrible. You really, if you're blocking an ambulance, you don't care about humanity. You know, you may be claiming to like be protesting to try to better the world, but you don't care about humanity if you block an ambulance. Yeah, cops block ambulances. Cops do that sometimes. Yeah. I've been reading like cops pull over, you know, parents speeding with their kid having a, you know, they can't breathe, asthma attack in the back of the car, and the cops like detain them and, you know, don't look. And the cop parents say, our kid's having an asthma attack, our kid's having a whatever. And the cop looks at him, he's like, looks all right to me, ma'am, and just, you know, detains him, and the kid dies. Mm-hmm. That's happened recently.
Yeah. Anyone who blocks an ambulance obviously places a low value on human life.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people are angry, man. Mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be angry, but then a lot of people are angry on top of that. I was talking to Phil Warmoth recently, who's a public school teacher, and he's a freedom fiend. I'm sure there's some people have issue with that, but I don't, because he really is changing it from the inside. I think that's one place. And he's not, you know, he's not like us. He's not politically, he doesn't think about politics all the time. He just kind of lives a good life. And he's been a public school teacher for, you know, 30 years. He's close to retirement even. And, you know, he does interesting things. Like he said one day he had a bunch of kids, and they were like, you know, he was showing them how to protest, and he's not a lefty. They weren't protesting, you know, the current things kids protest. And they were like, you know, they made signs, and they went out in the school, you know, on the side of the football field when no one was there. And he said that like a cop car saw them from the distance and came, drove up to them, and like basically did what I was talking about, like drove 5 miles an hour through them or 2 miles an hour through them. Like they had to move or they'd get run over. And he said like, that wasn't planned, kids, but that's your lesson for the day right there. You know, like the police came and, you know, some people would say like, why is it okay for the police for the police? The cop wasn't going there. The cop went out of his way and turned to do this.
Oh
yeah. But yeah, he basically talks about how like kids today don't have, a lot of kids today compared to when we were kids, don't have any real life skills. You know, they don't have, and I think that's the reason people end up angry. And you can go learn your life skills. on your own. I did. But they largely don't teach them in school, and kids are so brainwashed that school is where you learn things that they, which still surprises me, because at this point, everyone has, you know, the libraries of the world in their pocket on their phone. So,
yeah,
you know,
well, there may be things to be angry about, but it, when it comes to expressing that anger, I think they need to learn to do so in more effective ways. And when it comes to protesting the police, I wish more people knew about things like Dale Brown's Viper Threat Management and Cell 411, for example.
Yeah, Cell 411 is great. It's an app that a friend of ours, Virgil, makes. You want to talk about it? And then I want to talk about why I don't think Dale Brown's a good example. But go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, Cell 411 is an app that you can download on your phone. And you can create these things called cells, which are like networks of your friends and family, which can be alerted in case of an emergency. So depending on whatever happens. And there's also, you know, if you were to get harassed by the cops as well, you know, there's another button you can push to have people sort of show up and cop block or, you know, videotape the interaction. But there's all various things it can do. I think it does ride sharing now. There's a lot of interesting things you can do with that app. So I highly recommend it.
Yep. It's good. So Dale Brown,
just recently met Dale Brown.
Yeah. Where? Porkfest? Or the Michigan?
Well, the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. He was a speaker there.
Yep.
And I didn't actually get to attend his talk because I was volunteering for another, for the check-in tent.
Oh, you're running, you're a border guard?
I was a border guard.
Well, it's private property. It's okay to be a border guard. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
But, so I didn't get to see his presentation, but I did get to meet and talk with him. So, yeah, about Dale Brown, what do you know?
Dale Brown is racist and I don't want to say insane, but I think he would not be a good private peace officer. I've seen some threads on Facebook where he has screamed at people for, like, some guy I know who's an immigrant, you know, came here a long time ago, came here legally, and Dale Brown just started yelling at him and saying, like, oh, you only came to America so you can beat your wife and kids and get away with it. And he's like, what are you talking about? I've never done that. And he's like, yeah, well, people from that part of the world do that. And then he went on this tirade about how blacks in Africa who kill farmers for their land are just taking back what was theirs. He's not a good guy, man.
Okay, well, I've never actually interacted with him online.
Yeah, but you should Google him. Search him on Facebook. He seems cool in person. Search him on Facebook.
Really cool in person.
Search on Facebook, Dale Brown, and search posts and find some threads. He's been doing this a lot lately, like, you know, threads where he just screams at everybody. And I think that means he would not be a good peace officer because you know, private cop, you know, anybody who's acting in a police capacity, you don't want them escalating. And this guy sounds like he would escalate anything. And he has he's racist against white people, and he's racist against, he's anti-immigrant. He assumes immigrants are wife beaters. So that's not the guy you want patrolling your neighborhood in Detroit. And if he has any problem with this, I mean, what part of what I said is not true? Prove that, you know? Because I took screenshots of all this stuff, and it's loopy. And I talked to someone who knows him really well, and he's like, yeah, he can be, you know, whatever. He can be.
I've actually, you know, met Dale in person, and you know how people can be one person on the internet, and they seem like a completely different person in person. He seems like a really nice guy in person, and he really seems to know his stuff. I got to see, you know, how he was, you know, disarming people with firearms when you're unarmed. So that's really always good stuff to know. I actually got to meet Dale in person.
Yeah.
And he seems like a really nice guy in person, and he really seems to know his stuff.
I seem like a really nice guy in person, and I'm not.
Yeah, but a lot of us, you know, we try to be different people on the internet. Sometimes we can seem a lot a lot more intimidating than we might actually be. But I thought it was really cool. He showed us how to, like, when you're unarmed, how to disarm someone who's holding a firearm on you.
Yeah.
If someone's got a handgun, it's actually possible to disarm them if they're close enough. So
how do you, can you describe it?
Yeah. So basically, so if they're pointing the gun at you, all right, his first movement is it's very quick and to the side. You kind of like turn your shoulders and lean back that way that you're out of the line of fire. And then you reach in and you grab the gun and you tip it back and to the side, which causes them to release their grip on the gun. And you can usually get it out of their hands that way.
Yeah, it physically is impossible to grip when you're doing that because it pulls your opposable thumb and your finger apart, basically. It's the same idea of, you know, when you see movies and you see like the cop shoot somebody and then they slowly walk up to him while drawing down on him to make sure he's, you know, not just winged and going to grab a gun and shoot back. And when they approach him, they always either kick the gun away or step on his wrist and then reach down and remove the gun. Because if somebody's stepping on your wrist, you cannot grip anything. It just releases your grip.
That's good to know too.
Couple other tips. Like if you ever have to shoot anybody in self-defense, don't just think, oh, it's over. Okay. And then put your gun away. Get their weapon away. And, I'm not telling people how to capture people. This is just things I've read in books on self-defense. The general idea is basically make sure they don't have a weapon. Check them. If there's two people, do this together, because a lot of times, you know, someone's shot, they're kind of in shock. You reach down to see if they're alive, and then they're either faking or more likely they just kind of come out of shock for a minute and start fighting you again. Grab your gun. This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've run websites since 1996 and have used over a dozen web hosts in that time. AgoristHosting.com is the only one that hasn't broken my heart. Agorist Hosting's uptime and service is stellar, and their DDoS mitigation is the best I've seen. That's important because if you tell the truth in this world, you'll ruffle feathers. And some people will try dirty tricks to silence your voice. No matter what the haters hit us with, Agorist Hosting keeps our websites online. If you have a mission-critical commercial presence or a world-changing activism site, you cannot tolerate any skullduggery. So go with agoristhosting.com. Have a WordPress or blog site, but you're not satisfied with performance or uptime? Or just want raw hosting? Want to pay with Bitcoin? Agorist Hosting specializes in high-performance hosting with personalized service. Go to agoristhosting.com and click on the button that says Get Hosted. That's agoristhosting.com. The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net. I got a couple real news you can use here with guns is if someone's pointing a gun at you close, like you can grab their gun, but you can't get away from them, there's a couple things you can do to keep them from firing it. If they have a revolver, if you grab the cylinder and hold it tight so it can't spin, they cannot fire it. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that actually. Yeah,
that's an awesome one. And don't try this with a loaded gun pointing at your friends, but try this, you know, with an unloaded gun, or if it's a, if it's a revolver, or if it's a semi-auto, to do the semi-auto thing, I'm going to say you'd need those practice caps, which are like, you know, non-bullets that act like a bullet to allow the thing to cycle correctly. So with a semi-auto, with a, you know, like a 1911 or anything like that, or a Glock, if you grab the top of the slide and push on it, it can't fire. It's the same idea. So yeah, man.
Worms.
All right. So you got a topic. Anyway, so Dale, I just want to say Dale is, Dale's not a great guy. And I was looking for stuff to read that he said, and I don't want to pick on people on the air anymore, but I think that this needs to be pointed out about him, because this guy is everybody, every libertarian I know. When you talk about how would police work without a government, they say, well, there's this guy, Dale Brown, and it would work like what he does. He has this private police agency that's reasonably priced, and even poor people can afford his services. And he, you know, if somebody, even if they don't have money, if somebody's threatened by somebody, he'll go over and help them out. And he sounds like a great guy, but he is racist, angry, anti-immigrant. And, you know, for people who are like, well, we don't need any more immigrants, I'm talking about a guy who, you know, came here legally and has lived here 30 years, you know, came here as a teenager and has worked his whole life. He's never been on public assistance and he despises people who are. So, yeah, this guy's, I can't search anything and read what he's written as evidence though, because, I blocked him, but he's not, there's a couple Dale Browns. It's a fairly common name. There's a mystery writer or like a, you know, kind of Tom Clancy kind of writer with that name. But yeah, it's the large black man from Detroit who runs an organization called Threat Management. Black man. I didn't mean it like, hey, black man. I'm just saying, you know, describing him. So if you see a picture of him, you'll know which Dale Brown it is. He looks like a linebacker who's had a lot of cheeseburgers. Yeah.
I guess that's an accurate description. Yeah.
So, yeah, man, you want to talk about Sacha Baron Cohen?
Okay, so I guess Sacha Baron Cohen is going to be making a new movie or something called Who is America? But in the process, he's been trolling a bunch of conservatives into saying things about, you know, guns. And basically, he's created this fake program that he calls Kinder Guardians, where they train, you know, toddlers and, you know, young school children, school-age children, to handle weapons. And so instead of just arming the teachers, he's talking about arming the students too. And he's trying to troll these conservatives into saying things like that they believe they should arm students. And I know Sarah Palin was one of them. He trolled Bernie Sanders and a few other people, not just conservatives, but he talked to, what's his name? Is it Larry Sharp of Gun Owners of America? And he trolled him by
saying, let's get kids to carry guns. And these people said yes. And he said, look, he's basically saying, look at these idiots.
Basically, yeah, I guess.
That's not funny, man. That's not cool.
He's trying to straw man the conservative stance on guns, it seems.
And really, like, what's so wrong with that idea? I mean, I don't think there should be public schools. And I think if you handed out guns at public schools right now, there'd be an increase in violence. But, you know, homeschooling with responsible kids who are actually taught about guns. There was a kid in Idaho who was really small for his age. I think he was 14 and he was homeschooling and he was getting incessantly bullied and physically, you know, bullied by kids in the town in Idaho for being a homeschooler, for being small. And he started open carrying a loaded 22 rifle on his back. And the bullying stopped immediately. And he's a peaceful kid. It's legal in Idaho to do that at 14. Mm-hmm. And it just stopped. And the kid never shot anybody. And he was getting, you know, like he was in danger physically, not just emotionally. And I like that. I thought the kid's parents are a hero for letting him do that. But I don't like Baron Cohen that much. I mean, I kind of think some of his...
No, I never really did either.
His early
did some
work
questionable
is
stuff.
His early work is full. Yeah, it's morally questionable / reprehensible. He there's also a lot of creative editing. Like the thing where he went to a bar in Texas and played a song called Throw the Jew Down the Well. And then he made it look like a room full of cowboys loved that song. And that was lying, the editing. He had like two people on camera. One of them thought the song was good. Another one thought another song was good that he did. And they made it sound like it was about that song. And then the audience cheering along was not him playing that song. It was somebody else playing a different song the same night. So he just lies out his pants, you know?
And he even trolled Ron Paul.
He did troll Ron Paul and... It made him look kind of homophobic, although he might be kind of homophobic, but his homophobia doesn't involve government guns, so I don't see a problem. I see a problem with it, but it doesn't outrage me. It's like, oh, he's an old cranky man who, you know, grew up in a different time, but he doesn't think gays should be punished or anything like that. Like, you know, the way, like my problem is with the use of force, government force or private force, and just because he... you know, thinks people are a little weird if they have relations that aren't like him and his wife, you know, who, by the way, was his childhood sweetheart who he married and he's still married to at, you know, 79 or something. Sacha Baron Cohen. I mean, he's done some things that make me laugh. Like the first things I saw from him, I think, what was the character, the first character, the one, the most famous one?
Borat.
Yeah. Borat's kind of funny and kind of lighthearted and funny. He just got meaner too, as he got, you know what it is. Every comedian now who gets a laugh from people and is really good at it thinks they have to have a political message after a while. That's his problem, I think.
Yeah.
They think they have to be socially relevant. So, yeah. I don't think that's funny. I don't think that trolling gun people into making them look what he thinks looks bad by saying let's arm kids is a good thing. Do you?
No, I don't think so. But hopefully it's done in such a way that people realize it's a joke. Hopefully they don't take them serious.
I don't think a lot of young people know the difference with media between joking or not. I mean, I think a lot of people get their news from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and Colbert.
Could be.
Daily Show's not around anymore, but well, it is. It's somebody else doing it.
They probably just read The Onion for their news.
The Onion, yeah, which is a parody site, you know, making fun of it. But yeah, yeah. Oh, I just got an email from Jamie from Vantana Row, where I wrote him and said, just figured out Folly is your wife and not your sister, LOL. And she said, totally fair. I was enjoying it. I'd always wanted to stay in a band with my sister, Steph. She's the real drummer in the family, plays a lot like the late Vinnie Paul. Yeah, Steph's the one I remember. That's right. Steffi. Yep. Little Steffi. Yeah, that's... No, he's... So, yeah. Anyway, that guy, Borat, Cohen.
Yeah.
What about him?
I seen another one where he was playing the part of General Aladdin, I think it was.
That's his tyrant, like, right?
The dictator.
That guy's funny.
Yeah.
That's a funny character.
It is. Yeah. I like that character. And I think he was also in Talladega Nights.
Yeah, Borat used to be cool. Now he's just a tired old Hollywood person trying to stay relevant and get a laugh at the expense of all that's good. I mean, I'm all for making fun of things, but I also kind of think that I don't know if I think guns are sacred as a topic, but I kind of think that anybody who makes a big point of going after guns, even to get a laugh, I think is the enemy. I really do. Because that gets as a brainworm in the heads of young people and poisons them against guns. Yeah. You know?
He really does seem to be strawmanning the pro-gun argument, and yeah. I hope no one actually takes him serious.
They do. You hope? Yeah, the whole this is still funny is premised on the you hope no one takes him serious, and everyone takes him serious. The people that watch him and think he's funny, I think he tends to appeal to people with a lower IQ. I really do. You know, it's bonehead humor. It's Beavis and Butthead. It's like scripted live Beavis and Butthead, basically. And it's nothing new. It's Candid Camera. Do you know what Candid Camera was?
Yeah, I used to watch that.
You want to explain that?
Okay, that's kind of like one of those reality prank TV shows, kind of like Pranked, but it's like the original version. Where
well,
they
proto,
set up proto. Cameras.
I mean, it started in the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so they would set up hidden cameras and prank people, and then, you know, they would be like, smile, you're on candid camera or something like that. Yeah.
And that actually became a catchphrase. Like, there's some show I saw where, you know, there's a sting drug bust and the cops, like, you know, the guy buying the drugs pulls out a badge and a gun and says, smile, and points at the hidden camera and says to the dealer, smile, you're on handed camera, and cuffs the guy. You know, that used to be a saying when I was a kid.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. Smile, you're on candid camera. Yeah. And it was back when it was kind of hard to do when cameras were big and clunky and, you know, it took film and made noise and they had to hide them places. You know, now you can do that with, like, you know, a clip on tie pin. That's a camera with better audio.
Yeah. I remember like during the original, the first season of Cops, it was kind of like that, carrying these big cameras around.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's actually, do you remember that show, not Dragnet, the one after that, Adam 12, that cop show from the 70s. God, what was it called? Rampart. No, that was the fire and rescue one from the same neighborhood and the same producer. But there's a cop show. I think it was called Adam 12, or the cop car was one Adam 12. That show. There was actually an episode where, I mean, this is in the 60s. There was a guy cop blocking with a camera. Like, a whole episode was devoted to, you know, there was some film student from LAPD from UCLA who was trying to, you know, keep the cops honest and was following the police around, had a police radio and a little crew of three people, other students, you know, his girlfriend and some other dude holding the microphone and the sound recorder and following cops to wherever this one cop car to wherever they went, jumping out and filming, you know, not getting in the way, just being a good cop blocker, standing on the side in, like, this is like 1970 probably. And back then, like, filming something, even on, you know, he was using 16 millimeter. I could tell by looking at it. I mean, filming 16 millimeter and developing it in today's money would be about $15 a minute, you know, plus wow. your time. And this kid was doing it, and the cops just didn't know what to do. And they finally, they were like, well, you know, they talked to like the police attorney or something for the police department, the city attorney. And he said, well, is he getting in your way? And they're like, nope. And they're like, well, technically he's within his constitutional rights. You have to let him do it. And that was like the lesson. Can you believe that? They used to make cop shows wow. where like, that was the lesson, you know?
Yeah.
Weird. Yeah.
Oh, I miss those days.
But that show also had episodes where, like, you know, some lady smoked a reefer stick and accidentally killed the baby she was babysitting by negligence.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. A reefer stick. Those jazz musicians.
Reefer madness.
Reefer sticks. Yeah. So, but I got some good news about guns is the Department of Justice has ruled that 3D printed gun files are legal to share, which is a big boon for freedom and involves a friend of ours, Cody Wilson, who invented the printable gun.
Worms.
Worms. Yes, worms. For people that don't know, worms is what we say when we're happy or excited. It's kind of our aloha. And it started from this guy, Dave Immergluck, who played in my band Slish, who's now in Counting Crows. I call them Counting Sheep. I don't really like them. I like him, though. And yeah, he used to say worms, like back when people said word in the 80s. I mean, they stopped. Word stopped being cool in about 82. And in 86, as a joke, he was saying worms. And I just started doing it with Nima in 2011 when we did this show. And it just stuck. I mean, if you Google Freedom Fiends, one of the autofill is worms. Like, what does worms mean?
Wow.
Freedom Fiends. Okay, here's the autofill. Not logged into Google. Freedom Fiends. Freedom Fiends blog. Freedom Fiends Worms and Freedom Fiends Molyneux. I guess those are the most common searches because I did an expose on stuff on Molyneux where I interviewed a former member of his inner circle who said that he's a bad man. All right. So Cody Wilson, actually the first time I interviewed him, the first time he was interviewed was by me. It was on Anarchy Gumbo, my other, not short-lived, for a couple of years I had a side project where I just interviewed people. And I interviewed him. I heard about his idea to make a printable gun. It was before he made one. You know, he was like making waves, just suggesting that it could be done, that it should be done. And he wasn't even a gun guy. Like, he was a liberty guy, and he was kind of a left libertarian at the time. He's gone very far away from that. Although he still likes, who are those dead French guys with weird names? Not Bastiat, Bastier?
Proudhon?
I don't know. Yeah, he's quoted him and the other guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a good liberty guy, and he's a college student. He was going to law school in Austin or Houston. Southern guy, southern gentleman from Arkansas. Grew up around guns, but, you know, didn't own or carry guns at the time. But he wanted to do something for liberty. And he was like, well, I could do something with this or something with that. And how about printable guns? You know, then anybody could have a gun. Gun laws would be, you know, unenforceable. And I interviewed him. I called him up. He didn't want to do the interview. He was like, you know, I don't know. This might be troublesome. I just kind of want to do it quietly and put it out there. And I said, I pep talked him for like an hour. I was before the interview. I was like, no, you have to do this. This is a great idea. It has to be done. You should do it. And you should do the opposite of what you're doing. You're being meek about it. You should be bold about it. And he's like, huh,
right.
Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. And, you know, I'm not claiming any part of like I built that, but I did have a tiny catalyst role in it, or the show did, and I'm happy with that. He talks about that too in his book, his autobiography, that the first interview he did was on this show. And also he wanted to use the name Liberator, which I think came for discussion on there, because I was talking about how in World War II the United States government made really cheap little single shot 45s called the Liberator. Do you know about this?
Sounds familiar.
It's what his weapon, his first gun was named after, his first printable gun. And it was basically like, it was a stamped, not milled little handgun that was made by like a headlamp company, the headlamp division of Westinghouse, I think. And the idea was that they were going to drop them behind enemy lines to Jews and others in occupied Nazi Germany with little pictographic instructions and instructions in like Polish, Russian, German, a few different languages in English. And it came with like five rounds of 45 ammo, and it only fired one at a time, and it came with instructions of how to remove the one after you fire it. And it came with a little dowel that you had to use to poke the shell out, the brass out after you fire it to put in the next one. And the idea was, it was kind of psychological warfare more than actual, like, this is how we win the war. It was, the idea was it would terrorize the Nazis and demoralize them. And the idea was, you know, they'd said in the instructions, like, you know, have this gun, figure out how to use it, have it in your pocket, walk up to a German soldier, ask him for a light for your cigarette. And while he's doing that, your friend comes up and shoots him in the back of the head, in the base of the head, pointing up. And then you grab his rifle, you take his uniform and put it on, and then you go up and shoot other Nazis and then gather resources, you know, take the chocolate in their pocket, et cetera, get more guns. And it's an amazing idea. It's, you know, for something the government came up with, it's pretty smart. I like it. And that's what he named his first. I don't know if he had that idea or not, but I told him about how I'd seen one in person. They're extraordinarily rare, but there's one in the Firearms Museum in, of all places, Cody, Wyoming. And Cody Wilson thought that was pretty cool. So he's been a friend of the show. He's been on here a bunch of times, and he's become an international celebrity, you know, kind of the poster child for uncompromising, almost extreme liberty talk anarchism. Like, he was interviewed by Glenn Beck, and Glenn Beck called him the most dangerous man in the world, which is pretty bizarre. There are some men who are a lot more dangerous than Cody Wilson. There's people whose names you don't even know in my little town running around the street who are far more dangerous than Cody Wilson. You know, Cody's not dangerous. He's good.
Right on.
But the government, Department of Justice, sent him a cease and desist like 3 or 4 years ago saying, you know, you can't post the, you can't host these files of the, so basically the way 3D printers work is there's kind of little blueprint files and you feed them into a computer. They're little text files. They're small enough to email and you feed them into a computer that's hooked up to a 3D printer. And the 3D printer just takes a couple hours and prints whatever you told it to print, and it can print all the parts to make a 3D gun. Oh, except, and I think I might've helped with this idea too. The primer or the pin on his guns is a nail. And I suggest that the suggestion I made to him was using a nail for the primer and using a really low caliber bullet. I said a 22. He ended up with a 380 because he did the maths on it. And I also said the first time he tested it to put it in a vise, point it in a safe direction, and put a string on the a string on the trigger and be like 20 feet away behind a brick wall when you fire it the first time. And he did. So, but he, you know, and the nail, like in that interview, we talk about the idea of the nail, and he says, well, that's not 3D printed. I'm like, that doesn't matter. The idea is making a gun that anybody can make anywhere and anybody
nails
anywhere.
Are easily available.
Yes. Yeah. There are nails in every house in the world. You could pull a nail out of the wall if you had to, you know.
Yeah.
If it was martial law and all the stores were closed, you could find a nail in a house. You could pull it out of something in the basement, you know. So yeah.
Right.
So Cody's great, and the government basically, like, he was facing prison and he was denounced by name on the floor of Congress. That's success as an activist, I think, right there.
Yeah.
And you know, he started doing really confrontational things, like before he made a gun, he made 3D printed mags because that was easier. And he called the first one the Feinstein and the other one named after some other gun grabbing politician. Who's the guy? Schumer? The Schumer? Yeah. And he's a rabble rouser and I love it. He's actually now running something that's a free speech oriented. It's kind of like Patreon, but it's called Hatreon. Do you know about this?
Oh, I've only heard of it.
Did you know it's him?
I did not know it was him.
Yeah, it's really controversial because it's basically like a Patreon kind of thing for people that get kicked off of Patreon. And that ends up right now, most of them being alt-right. And he's not alt-right, but he's one of these people who's like, I may not agree with you, sir, but I will fight and die for your right to free speech. And a lot of people say that, but not a lot of people will actually like face the fire of starting a system so people with really disagreeable ideas can have free speech and collect money for it, you know? So he also made, he worked with a programmer to make something called Dark Wallet, which I don't know if it ever really worked. I've never talked to anyone who's used it, and I know it was in eternal beta, but it was a mixing service for Bitcoin. Do you know about this?
Oh, like a Tumblr tumbling service.
Yeah, basically a money laundering software service for, but it was decentralized. Like you didn't have to have a central point. It worked, you know, in a sub network of Bitcoin. And I mean, I think it worked, but I think the last one I saw, the last one he did, I think said like, you know, don't use this with any large amounts of Bitcoin. We're still testing. Use minute amounts. But yeah, it mixed your money in with other money, so it wasn't traceable to a particular person, which is, I think, just the fact that he made a beta of that, whether it worked or not, I think that's an act of liberation because it scared a lot of people, a lot of politicians, a lot of square people. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think probably a lot of people don't realize the Lightning Network is kind of capable of doing the same thing, the way that it routes
the transactions. Is that a sidechain of Bitcoin?
It's a second layer solution, kind of like a sidechain, yeah.
Sidechain's a radio term. I don't know why I'm saying that. Or is sidechain also a blockchain term?
It is actually kind of a blockchain term now because now they have these different types of blockchains that are more complicated, and it's kind of DAGs are decentralized acyclic graphs, which are kind of like block lattices.
Wow.
It's like a network of blockchains, yeah.
Is that where you can – you're smart. You're smarter than I am. Do you know – is that where you can do – what are they called? Atomic swaps, where you swap from one coin to another without going through a service?
Yeah, Lightning Network has a smart contract layer on it that is able to do atomic swaps.
Is this for Bitcoin or Ethereum or everything?
Just things that are compatible with Lightning Network at this point. So that accounts for Litecoin,
Bitcoin,
Bitcoin,
Namecoin.
Possibly Namecoin. I'm not sure.
No, Namecoin
but
is
Monero
Namecoin,
is getting on board with that.
Namecoin
pretty soon
is too. Well, Namecoin is the first altcoin, and it is literally a clone of Bitcoin that adds the capacity to put in text. Well, Bitcoin does too, but makes it easier. It was. Now, the guy who made Namecoin, or the guy who's a dev of it now, said on Twitter that it was technically Litecoin was the first altcoin, even though Namecoin came out before that, because he doesn't consider Namecoin an altcoin, because he's considering altcoins things that just do. I think it's kind of a weird designation. He thinks that altcoins are things that don't do anything unique, that just imitate another coin. And it's kind of weird to me. I don't understand how Monero could be on that network if it has to be similar, because Monero is a crypto knight algorithm, and it's worlds away from Bitcoin in its programming, whereas Litecoin and Namecoin and probably the first, you know, 20 altcoins back in the day were all very close to Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think they were cloned off of the Bitcoin code itself. But I think all they need to do is be SegWit compatible, and that might not even be necessary. And I know Fluffy Pony was just recently talking about updating Monero so that it will be compatible with Lightning Network.
Well, talked about it meaning they're on it, or let's think about this.
That's one of their projects that they're going to be working on in the near future.
Because one of the projects that they're working on in the near future, too, a couple years ago was something that does what Namecoin does, but does it right. You know, something that allows you to register domain names that are uncensorable on a blockchain. I think that a lot of people throw ideas at Monero because it's a really popular coin, and it's also got a strong dev community. I mean, it's got 12 to 20 primary developers other than Fluffy Pony, who's kind of the head. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying anything bad about that. I'm just saying, just because you hear, I hear a lot of stuff about Monero is going to do this, Monero is going to do that. And I think a lot of times it's a wish list. But if Fluffy Pony says they're doing it, then they're probably doing it.
Yeah, I believe that is actually one of the things they're going to try to do pretty soon. I think Lightning Network's very promising. And the more coins that are compatible with it, the better it's going to be.
Litecoin is, right?
Litecoin
was one
is,
of the first.
Yes.
And SegWit, right? Litecoin put in SegWit before Bitcoin, right?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's people listening to us who are like, this is all Greek to me on radio listening, but I think the thing that's probably making them scratch their head the most, and you know, I mean, nothing wrong with that, like this is it's a lot to learn, and we're just kind of throwing it at you as if you know it, but I think the thing that's probably baffling them the most is the name of the person, Fluffy Pony.
Oh, well, that's a nickname. I think it's a forum nickname
it is.
For Ricardo Spagnoli, who is the lead developer on the Monero project.
Yes, who's a South African citizen. What if he's still in South Africa? If I had money, which he does, I would get out of South Africa if I were a white man. They're hunting them like dogs there. You know about that?
I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I haven't been following it.
Well, there's like politicians like in office, like basically congressmen who are like giving speeches to thousands of people and saying like, you know, singing songs about kill the boar, you know, kill the white farmer, and like chant. There's videos of like thousands of people chanting along to this. And
well,
you know,
it's been very polarized in South Africa for a long time, and it used to be the whites were in control oppressing the blacks, and now that the blacks are in control, they think it's their turn to oppress the whites.
That's the weirdest. That's the problem with a lot of people's opinion of wanting equality. You know, is like equality isn't what it should be, which is everyone. Everyone has a fair chance, and no one gets in the way of people more than other people based on anything like race or creed or sexual, whatever. A lot of leftism in general, you know, communism, socialism, left politics teach that it's not only equality is not only that, but is punishing people for being the thing you're not because their grandparents did something. And it's also leftism is also they don't have a distinction between positive and negative rights, and they don't have a distinction between a negative right. It sounds weird. Negative rights are good things. Positive rights are bad things. Negative rights are you have the right not to have your home searched by the police. Positive rights are you have the right to have your education and healthcare paid for by other people. Positive rights are bad.
Sometimes negative and positive rights are differentiated as liberties versus entitlements.
Ah, there you go. That's a good delineation. Yeah. But I think another thing that leftists have a problem with is thinking that they confuse or intentionally blur the idea of everybody, nobody being put down and prevented from having natural right opportunities based on anything they're born with or are versus, entitlements to those things. Like, you know, they think like a level playing field, a true level playing field should be you're not punished for showing up, but it doesn't mean you get to go ahead six spaces ahead of the other people, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yes. So good thing with Cody. He's not going to prison. He's not going to federal pound me in the prison for 10 years for sharing documents on the internet. You know, the funny thing is, though, and I think this may have been why the Department of Justice changed, is I think they may realize what the Streisand effect is now. And they may realize that by trying to stop this, more other people did it. Like before, Cody was sharing the files. And after Cody was told he couldn't share the files, Cody was not sharing the files. But about 10,000 people started sharing the files, including people who'd never. This is like there's some activists I heard through Pirate Bay who were like leftist anarchists who like didn't like guns, didn't think people should own guns, didn't live places people could own guns, but seeded the files anyway because they considered it free speech. Like that's right. The old kind of leftist, that's the good kind of leftist, you know, from back in the day. They're few and far between now.
Yeah,
you know.
But I think the one headline I did see on the Cody article, they were talking about how the Second Amendment is now kind of protected also by the First.
Who said that? Cody or the...
I think it was one of the article headlines I had seen on this Cody ruling.
Oh, the Department of Justice didn't say that, though.
Well, no, they didn't say that.
Okay, I didn't think so. That'd be weird.
Yeah, the headline of the article claimed that the Second Amendment was now also protected by the First, or that he blurred the line between the First and Second Amendment. Something like that.
Well, and the First Amendment has always been protected by the Second Amendment. In places where people can't own guns, they often can't speak freely. In places people can own guns, they tend to be able to speak more freely. I mean, I have said things on this show, you probably have too, but I've definitely said things on this show that could get me thrown in jail in Canada and much of Europe today. I've said things here today.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think pointing out that someone's black when you're talking about them in a discussion of them being racist is probably technically illegal in some places in Europe and Canada.
Well, yeah.
Almost.
Racism is a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And as much as they try to deny its existence.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a common thing. I've seen a lot of Black Lives Matter type people and a lot of, you know, young white college student leftists who are useful idiots for them. Say things like, it's impossible for a black person to be racist. I've heard that. You ever heard that?
I have heard that before.
Yeah.
And they use some lame leftist excuse. Yeah. To explain why.
I went to a boarding school that was one third black kids from inner city Philly. And black people can be racist in my experience. Although I guess what they're saying is that's not racism. That's okay. You know? Yeah.
Well, yeah, I do. I guess that occurs just about anywhere you go. But I have noticed, like, where I'm from up north, I'm originally from Fort Wayne, Indiana, and there's a lot less racism up there. It's a lot more integrated than it is the farther south you go. So
that's near Chicago, here in right? Is that near Chicago?
It's about just as far north of Chicago. It's about 2 or 3 hours east of Chicago. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a meme somewhere that was like white kids kind of dress in hip-hop but kind of looked like, you know, they're on their way to go work on the farm, and it said, Indiana, Hogwarts for Chicago gangs.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
You could say that's about right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think the backwards baseball cap had a corn cob on it and said DeKalb.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that is northern Indiana. So. Yep, that's where I'm from, northern Indiana. And so, it's pretty much like that.
So a couple things we're going to close up with here. One is, yeah, man, let's talk about Richard Alpert. Who's Richard Alpert?
Yes, Richard Alpert was one of the colleagues of Timothy Leary, who later became known as Baba Ram Dass.
That wasn't racist. That was me doing my Catskills comedian imitation of how Henny Youngman would say it. Henny Youngman? Benny Youngman? Yeah, Ram Dass. Yeah, was he a professor, Harvard?
Yeah, Harvard professor, I think, of psychology.
Ex-professor, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was a college professor, white, American, Jewish dude, went to India, came back an Indian guru with his name Ram Dass, and took a lot of LSD, hung out with Timothy Leary, changed the world. I'm sure there are people listening who are like, Timothy Leary, that guy's the devil. That guy gave acid to kids. Well, first of all, Timothy Leary, while he was the first person other than the Beatles to really openly talk about how psychedelic drugs could be a useful tool. He was actually against widespread, unguided, unsupervised use of it. Like the acid tests in California, you know, where the Grateful Dead played and
Ken Kesey.
Yeah, Ken Kesey. And they had like parties that were public and it cost a couple bucks to get in and the punch had LSD in it. Timothy Leary thought that was a horrible idea. Timothy Leary actually said that should be illegal. And this is when LSD was legal. I mean, he was kind of weird that he'd go to that should be illegal. But Timothy Leary is attributed with a lot of things that he really wasn't. He was, just opening some doors, talking about maybe things should be a little different in how people can treat their own mind. You know, I mean, here's the thing, like, drugs are powerful and can warp you and can twist you. And I've seen acid casualties, and I've also seen people who've done it a few times and not only live to tell about it, but it's vastly improved their life and their outlook on things. Certain psychedelics can help with depression, with PTSD. And I think a lot of people just shut it down because the government made up lies. Like, LSD does not cause chromosome damage. I don't think that a pregnant woman should take it, but that's a lie about the chromosome damage. You know, the story about the babysitter who put the baby in the oven and the turkey in the bassinet on LSD. That's an urban myth. There were basically anything the government tries to stop really hard that some people enjoy, you should probably wonder if it's really a bad thing, because I think what LSD did that the government didn't like was it opened people's minds to, even after they did it once, they were forever changed in a way that made them kind of ungovernable. You know, it freed the slaves in a pill. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It has a way of deconditioning, programming and, conditioning. So the government, who makes a kind of a living off of programming and conditioning us, doesn't want us to decondition those pre-programmed responses.
And it could also be used for programming in a sinister setting, which is, the government is not entirely anti-LSD. They just don't want people owning it and being able to distribute it. The government used LSD as part of their MK Ultra CIA program, gave it unwittingly to people who to see what would happen, to see if it could be used as a psychological weapon of war. And one scientist jumped out a window while on it. Now people say, oh, acid makes you jump out the window. Well, he was given to it it was given to him in a drink without his knowledge, and then people messed with his head. It was like a meeting of scientists that worked for the CIA. You know, they basically did like a Russian roulette thing where they put it in like two glasses out of six glasses of liquor they passed out, and then the people passing them out were definitely drinking liquor without it in it, and everybody had one glass, and this guy was given an immense amount of LSD. And then they started messing with him, like, what's wrong, Bill? You don't look good, Bill. Do you feel okay, Bill? How's your head, Bill? How's your wife, Bill? I was talking to your wife today, Bill. No, she was talking to me. She called me, you know, just messing with him. And he ended up jumping out, you know, maybe, Bill, what's out that window? Maybe you can fly, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely, well, one thing Leary talked about was set and setting. And, you know, if you're going to have an experience like that, you want to definitely do it consensually, but then you also want to control the environment that you do it in.
The set.
You want to do it in the right place with the right
setting.
People.
And the set is your mind. Your mood.
Yeah, the mindset and the setting.
So like he wouldn't recommend doing it at a concert where there's 10,000 people dancing, or, you know, a party where there's, you know, 100 people who came in off the street and you don't know any of them and it's unpredictable. You know, he liked to do planned settings where they'd discuss it a few days ahead of time. They'd have a quiet room in a house out in the woods with a bunch of pillows and tapestries and beautiful art and pretty classical music playing. I mean, kind of almost a square setting, like somewhere between academic, you know, study test, like a test subject setting, but, you know, with a few throw pillows and kind of pleasant. Like originally he was, I think he took it as part of a government experiment originally, didn't he?
Well, I think his very first experience with psychedelics was psilocybin done in Mexico. I think it's Oaxaca or something, Mexico.
One of those words with an X and an O and a and, unpronounceable by and modern tongue that hasn't been cut out.
So that was his first experience. And his original experiments at Harvard were with psilocybin until he could get a hold of LSD from Sandoz Laboratories.
Who still exist. I mean, I got some like prednisone once that was from Sandoz. They still make, that's still a company. And they invented LSD. Yeah. And Bayer Aspirin invented heroin. Let's see, what else? But pot's just God's gift. It just grows everywhere. I don't even do drugs. I used to do drugs. I got sober in 94. But I, you know, a lot of people who get sober are really in favor of drugs being strongly illegal. It's creepy. Like a lot of people from NA that I met, you know, were like, if crystal meth had been illegal, I wouldn't have done it. And I'm like, no, you would have. You just, you know, still, it is.
Right.
It's illegal and you did, you know, but they're like, if it was the death penalty, I wouldn't have done it. And I'm like, yeah, you would have, you know. The war on drugs actually creates more drug use. It's kind of bizarre. It's an unintended consequence, or probably an intended consequence at this point, because they want to have a reason to be paid enormous amounts of money, to have enormous amounts of toys, to basically go hunt humans for sports. And yes, that is what drug arresting police do. They hunt humans for sport.
Yeah. You can't stop the drugs, just like you can't stop the guns.
Yeah. It's funny, too. People who love guns and believe strongly and know in their heart, like, you know, when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. But not even that. Like, you know, honest people will still have guns. They'll just do it quietly. Like those, there's some of those people who think that more laws will make drugs stop.
Right. It's a false, it's cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. So Timothy Leary actually did, I just looked it up. Timothy Leary did an authorized Harvard study where he gave psychedelic drugs to students and observed them and asked them questions and published a study on it. And that's, Ram Dass was involved with that. Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, they both ended up getting kicked out of Harvard. Like, you can't be doing this in the name of Harvard. Right. And Timothy Leary actually did a lot of speaking engagements when I was... This dates me, but it also says how weird I was young. When I was 12, Timothy Leary spoke at Edinburgh State College in Pennsylvania, which was, you know, an hour drive from where I lived in Westfield, New York. And I was 12 or 13, and I knew, and I'd never done LSD. I was just curious about it and had read about it a lot. And I'd read Timothy Leary's book, High Priest, which they had at the local library, the Patterson Library, or as I call it in a Bip Tunia song, the James T. Prednisone Library, because I couldn't remember the name of it, and I was on prednisone for asthma. But I wanted to go hear him speak. And my friends who were like 18, I was 12 or 13 and had friends who were 18, which is 18 and 19, which is probably kind of weird, but I was smart. And so nobody my age was smart enough to hang out with. And they, you know, three or four of my friends, two or three of my older friends were driving to Edinburgh State College to hear Timothy Leary speak. And I really wanted to go. And my dad knew one of these people, you know, he's friends with the guy's dad. And I'm like, Dad, I want to go hear Timothy Leary speak. It's only $4. I have the money from my paper route. Can I go? And he's like, over my dead body, you know, didn't say that, but that was his attitude. Like, no son of mine is going to go hear, you know, the high priest of high speak and be corrupted. And I'm kind of like, it's already too late. I read his book and, you know, within a year, I'm going to be doing things in that book. So, but I just wanted to hear the guy speak. I actually never got to hear him speak, but dig him. And Ram Dass, I dig this movie. What is it called? Living and Dying in L.A. with Ram Dass? No, it's Dying to Know, Ram Dass and Timothy Leary, which is a film Dying that was made when Timothy Leary had cancer. And was he sick in it too, Ram Dass?
I don't believe so.
No.
But
oh, he had a stroke that left him with expressive aphasia. That's it. Yeah, he like was kind of, he's kind of frozen in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, and Timothy Leary was dying of cancer. And Timothy Leary dying of cancer, and it took a while for him to die of cancer, a year or two. And he had a better attitude dying of cancer than a lot of people have when everything's going well. It's something to learn from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you were mentioning Bill Gates earlier. How does Bill Gates relate to Ram Dass?
Oh, he doesn't. If you got more on Ram Dass, spill it, brother. Then I'll close with Bill Gates.
Well, I don't have a lot more on Ram Dass, but I did read a lot of the authors of the time. I was a Timothy Leary fan, and I also liked Allen Ginsberg and Alan Watts. Timothy Leary, in his autobiography, talks about hanging out with all those guys back in the 60s, and it's kind of funny how they all kind of knew that whole entire counterculture, like they knew each other at the time as if it was like a really small world.
Well, they also
been a really cool circle of friends.
They also were and that's all true, but Leary and Dass were actually also kind of like power mover and shakers who were trying to consciously make this thing into a revolution, like go, you know, an evolution of the mind. Like they were sending out press releases to Time and Life, and, you know, because they were from Harvard and they were known before that, they were taken seriously. Like they were, it was really strategically done. A lot of people don't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I actually heard Ginsberg speak at Charlottesville at UVA. You know, Ginsberg dated a guy when Ginsberg was like 70, dated a guy who was like 21, who dated a woman who I dated. So by the transitive properties of ew, no. Okay.
Uh-oh.
ew. I think saying ew, I think that'd be illegal in Canada. Like, no, I'm not saying gay people are gross. I'm saying any kind of lineage directly from me to ew. No. Okay. yeah. But you know, Phil Warmoth, our freedom fiend who I do Biptunia with sometimes, he does poetry. The public school teacher teaches a class on beat poetry in his school.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's not, and it's an elective class. You know, it's like you stay after school for the, or you do it. I don't know if it's after school or what, but you don't have to do it. And it's, you know, it's usually like seven kids sign up for it or something, but you know, high school kids, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Worms.
Yeah. The thing I didn't like about the beats was they didn't edit, or at least they said that the first draft is the only pure draft and editing is wrong. Although I think a lot of the beats were edited by people at their publishers, you know, by the editor at their publisher. And I think, you know, they didn't have computers back then. It was like, what's his name? Moriarty. What's the writer's name? Who wrote Dean Moriarty? On the Road, Kerouac. Oh. Like Kerouac supposedly like would stay up on speed for a week writing, and the rumor is that he got butcher paper and put it through a typewriter so he wouldn't have to change pages, and his manuscript was like, you know, 350 foot piece of paper. You ever heard
like
that?
A big scroll.
Yeah, scroll. You know, I'd be willing to bet that if that's true, or even if it wasn't true, that whatever he turned in, you know, somebody tried to make a little more sense of.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. We've been doing Phil and I've been doing the cut up technique, which was popularized by William S. Burroughs. You know, where basically Burroughs would take newspapers and cut strips up and then rearrange them and use it in writing. We've been doing that with computers. Phil does it with the way Burroughs did it. Burroughs didn't invent it, but he popularized it. I do it with a computer program. But the key to it that Phil and I found is editing after you do it. Don't take the first draft of the cut up. And we do it with our own words. And there's actually a Biptunia cut up generator on the Biptunia site. Search Biptunia cut up generator. It'll be the first result. It's basically the first three, all the lyrics for the first three Biptunia albums, you press a button and it rearranges 10 lines of it into random stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, and it takes like between 3 and 8 words at a time. And it's pretty cool. We've made a song out of that too. I dig it.
I do remember that song you made out of that.
Yeah. Yep. And Selby, Hubert Selby Jr. was lumped in with the Beats, but was not one of the Beats and didn't like being associated with the Beats because they didn't edit. And he, like most good writers, spent more time editing than he did writing. I mean, really, the act of writing, I think, in my experience, as having been a professional writer, is about 25% writing and about 75% editing, time-wise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yep. That's why the people you see writing screenplays in Hollywood, in Starbucks, never make money. Because they're always writing, they're never editing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, Bill Gates. So this isn't really about Bill Gates. This is about the man who could have been Bill Gates, which is the name of a somebody wanted to talk to me on the phone. I had to write him back and say when I'd talk to him. Fantana Row, Jamie from Fantana Row. We're going to talk for the first time in 20 years. It's going to be great. I'm psyched.
Oh, nice.
Yep. So, yeah, so the guy who could have been Bill Gates. Now, it's kind of maybe a specious, like, yeah, maybe he could have, but if he'd had the skills, but he didn't. But so there was a guy who invented an operating system called DOS, Disk Operating System. Actually, it was called QDOS, which predated DOS. It was called Quick and Dirty DOS. Trying to find the guy's name. Let me just Google it. Will you Google, while I'm telling the story, will you Google the man who could have been Bill Gates on YouTube for me?
All right.
All right. So this guy invented an operating system called C/something. It was like basic level, like, you know, DOS, kind of like the thing that the things go on top of, you know, the thing under the program. So he invented this operating system, and IBM wanted to get into personal computers. This is in the late 70s, early 80s. Because, you know, the Mac had come out and suddenly computers weren't just big things that took up a house and were only for corporations and governments and universities. They were things that everybody should own, you know, and the Mac came out and it was really expensive, but people still bought it a lot and they loved it. But IBM, the biggest computer company in the world and one of the biggest companies in the world at the time, wanted to get into the personal computer market. So they basically designed a computer that used off-the-shelf parts, which was rare because IBM usually built everything from scratch, but they wanted to get in quick. So in about 9 months, they had a computer ready for sale. It was built from off-the-shelf parts. It was a lot cheaper than the Mac, but the Mac came with like complete software operating system and, you know, word processing and spreadsheets and graphics programs on it, even from the get-go, and was easy to use by people who, you know, like people could be taught to use a Mac in a half hour and be an hour and be using it, which was not true of other computers at the time, of mainframe computers. You needed, you know, college level lessons to use them. So it was the computer for the masses, for the people, for the proletariat with, you know, $10,000 in today's money. But
right.
So they needed an operating system for it. So they went to this guy. Did you find his name yet?
Gary Kildall.
Gary Kildall. Yeah. They went to Gary Kildall, yeah, who had made an operating system called C, what was it called? C/something. And they wanted to license it from them. They called him up and said they were going to come over. And he was kind of a carefree hacker, libertarian type, like a lot of hackers were back then. Like, he didn't keep his appointment. He was out fishing or something, or doing some hobby thing, flying model airplanes, I think. And he wasn't home. And his wife said, well, he's not home. I don't know when he'll be home. This is before cell phones. So they didn't, you know, and IBM were really stern and businesslike, and they were visiting him at his house, and they were like, well, ma'am, we need you to sign a non-disclosure.